Hello, and welcome to the January 23rd, 2024 episode of the Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. This is Craig W. Hurst, Emeritus Professor of Music, podcasting from my music bunker, along with my faithful canine companion, Carmel the Wonder Dog, to share with you my latest musical interests and discoveries. I claim no special inside information about the latest or greatest music, nor do I know everything there is to know about music. What I am is a lover of music. I enjoy several genres of music, and I share with you what has currently caught my interest, old, new, outdated, and everything in between. Even old music is brand new if you have never heard it before. The universe of music is a vast one to enjoy. From my discussions, you might find something new to you and of interest to expand your own musical universe. I currently receive no compensation or motivation of any kind from any recording label, recording artist, or the estate of any performer or composer dead and gone to discuss their music and or recordings. Now with that out of the way, welcome to my musical universe. Find me somewhere out on the road. Take me into your heart and into your home. Caroline Cotter sings in the first song on her third album, Gently As I Go. The new music takes listeners around the world and deep into human emotions, reminding them that home can be anywhere if you found someone who shares your heart. Don't Wait, the first single from Gently As I Go, encourages listeners to seize the day. A reminder that we have in our power the ability to take action and create our present and future. Ironically, though the singer-songwriter ended up waiting 3 years to release her new album, she had just finished recording the 11 songs in March of 2020, and with the world reeling, she simply couldn't find a reason or the motivation to share them. To me, at that time, it felt unimportant, Cotter admits. Fortunately, the past 3 years have only strengthened Cotter's belief in these songs while further defining her own essence. Gently As I Go explores travel and connection, essential to who Caroline is, as well as things many of us experience, such as procrastination, love, life and death, nostalgia and growing up, loss and gratitude. Songs dealing with difficult transitions that we face continue to pop up throughout the album. Throughout, Cotter's smooth, tremulous soprano and calming delivery are reminiscent of the female folk singers who came before her, Mary Chapin Carpenter or Natalie Merchant, for example. Often, the peace Cotter's songs bring is as much for her as it is for her audience. We really do already have all that we need. And yet, without confidence, our fullest life can appear murky or completely out of reach. Prior to making music her full-time pursuit, Cotter traveled the world working in international education. Quitting her job in 2015, even without much of a fan base and on a shoestring budget, she trusted that touring was the best way for her to forge connections. There's just this opening of doors that happens that totally shifts things. It's a complete game changer, notes Cotter, a Rhode Island native now living just outside Acadia National Park in Maine. When I've shared myself in this way, then people are really excited to share what they've got around them. But what's a globetrotter who has played more than 1,000 shows in 45 states and 14 countries to do when a worldwide pandemic makes travel nearly impossible? I became very close to nature and just hugged a lot of trees and rocks, says Cotter. She nannied, worked on a goat farm, gardened, revitalized an arts nonprofit, and taught music and songwriting. In a way, I had to reinvent myself. I had to find a deeper sense of belonging and meaning in things that weren't what I knew of myself for the prior 15 years. I identified as a traveler, a singer-songwriter, and a performer, and all of a sudden I had nobody to sing to and nowhere to go. Caroline released her debut album in 2015 and a second album in 2018, and is both a 2018 Fresh Grass No Depression Songwriter of the Year Award finalist and a 2019 Rocky Mountain Folks Fest Songwriter Showcase finalist. Songwriting for me is a cathartic expression of my life's experience. It's creative expression that just completely shifts me and gets out the ickiness, shares Cotter, recounting a recent moment when sitting down and writing a song wiped away the anxious feeling she had been dealing with all day. Seeing new things and connecting with people helps also, because I can get so deep into my own head. And the second I start a conversation with somebody else, it's not about me anymore. And it's a win-win. It's inevitable that after a show, somebody will come and share their experience with me, Cotter says. So it's got the right effect, you know. It helps us all feel not alone. It is my pleasure to welcome to my musical universe, Caroline Cotter. Hello, Caroline.
Hi, Craig. How are you?
I'm doing quite well, thank you. It's great to talk with you, and very pleased to have you as a guest today on my show, and looking forward to learning more about you and your music. I'd like to get right to your new album that was released in August of 2023, Gently As I Go. Mm-hmm. Now, after reading your bio and looking at the lyrics to many of the songs on the album, I have come to the conclusion that you are someone who's been on the go for some time. Could you talk about that a bit?
Sure. Yeah, I got introduced to international travel when I was in college. I did a study abroad program that got me really excited about exploring more, and said yes to every opportunity that came my way, and then wanted to keep it going and looked for opportunities to work abroad when I was after college, when I graduated. Mm-hmm. And found some opportunities to continue that international exploration. And I worked in Thailand, I worked in France, I worked in Spain, I worked in Portugal, and I went to grad school out in Colorado. That was part of a work study program as well. And then I found this job that allowed me to continue that type of exploration. I was working for a nonprofit that organizes international exchange programs. And so I was, mm-hmm. I was traveling with that. And then, you know, eventually I decided that I wanted to put more energy into my music, and mm-hmm. Left that day job to play shows as many as I could, and in as many places as I could, mm-hmm. and continued the travel and the exploration that way, just mm-hmm. Powered by my music.
Okay. So this exchange program that you worked for, was that an educational exchange, I assume?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, so you worked in education then?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, okay. And did you have teaching in your background, or just?
I did. I taught English, and I taught early childhood education. Those were the two things that I taught before I went into this nonprofit that put me more on the organizational side of things.
Yeah, I thought at one time, I went to Japan in 1995 on a cultural exchange tour, and I loved it over there. And while I was there, I met a guy who was from the United States who was an English teacher. And he said, yeah, he says, if you ever want to move to Japan and find a way to do it, he said, just sign up to become an English teacher because the Japanese really want to learn English and you can, you know, teach those classes and find a way to live. Well, and I thought about it for a while. It'd be kind of interesting. And because I've never had the wanderlust, perhaps that you've had. I'm really much more of a homebody now, I guess. But I sure did like the idea at one time of traveling and because there's a certain amount of excitement to that and new things that you discover about other cultures and so forth. And so, yeah, but that sounds like an interesting way to come in from a landing and then start working and focusing more on your music. So let's talk about a few of the songs that are on the album. I'm going to highlight some that stood out to me. And then if there's any others you would like to talk about, certainly feel free to do so. You know, and I know that asking a songwriter to talk, you know, to pick their favorite songs, that would be like asking them a parent, who's your favorite child? but anyway, some of the songs that stood out to me was Morning Mantra, which is the last song on the album. And I guess it stood, you know, when I listen to an artist's work, I almost always will start with the last song.
Oh, that's fun. I like that idea. I've never thought to do that.
I'm always kind of curious, you know, what is the last word that this singer-songwriter wants us to leave with once we listen to this entire recording? And, you know, because certainly we have certain plans and things when we design the order of tunes on a recording. But anyway, I always like to kind of start with the last one. And Morning Mantra really came across to me as what I remember from my Ed Psych days, an optimistic auto-suggestion, such as was coined by Emile Cui, who was the French psychologist. He's the one that, you know, used to have a Cuiism. Every day and every way, I'm getting better and better. Every day and every way, I'm getting better and better. And so these optimistic auto-suggestions were, I guess, designed to help us stay on the shiny, bright side of life. Because there were positive affirmations about ourselves or about how we look at. But the way you ended the album with this song also seems, you know, kind of like a significant sort of positive self-talk. Would you talk about Morning Mantra and maybe why you chose to have it as the last song on the recording?
Yes, I think you're right on. I think the auto suggestion is exactly what I was going for, and you know, I call it a mantra because I've practiced and studied yoga, and different types of yoga have mantras that are included in the in the practice. And so, for me, this was just like that, something. A positive affirmation to start the day.
Okay.
And I like your idea of the last word, even of the whole album. It's belong. And when I fall, may I know that I still belong. And I hadn't thought about that until you just mentioned that. I like that idea a lot. Gently as I go. And then the last word of the album being belong is a really nice idea. So these are this a cappella ditty. I had written a similar one for the first album called I Am Satisfied. And I write these for myself in hopes that they can be helpful to other people as well.
Okay.
Yeah, sort of a sing-along, something to bring to an audience that can be something that we all sing together.
Sure. Well, it's you know, so it was it a conscious decision to make it the last song on the album?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
To end with something uplifting and,
Sure.
and motivating. And I think that there's some dark material on this album, but I really did want to end with something uplifting.
Well, I agree. I think that a lot of what I find singer-songwriters write about are many times personal experiences. It's a way to kind of get things off your chest, so to speak, internal conflict or relational conflicts or emotional kinds of feelings. And I think that that's, I think I have a question later where I ask you if you find that your songs are cathartic. I would suggest you've answered that question by, you know, already saying that, yes, they are. And I often think back to a video documentary I used to show my students about the blues. And in the documentary, one of these old blues musicians, he says, you know, one way to get rid of the blues is to sing the blues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and having that opportunity to, talk about your feelings and express your feelings and kind of as a way of putting it out there. Or there's that practice, and I can't remember the origin of this practice, where you write things, all the things that have happened to you in a year that you felt like were bad.
Mm.
You write them down on a piece of paper, and then you light a match to the paper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just kind of a way of letting things go so that you can go on. And maybe songwriting and writing poetry and so forth is has a similar sort of motivation.
Absolutely.
Some of the other songs that stood out to me, all of them are great songs. I'm just, you know, I don't think we could necessarily talk about all of them in an hour, but I wanted to highlight some. But the other one is The Call.
Mm.
And The Call really seemed, I really enjoyed, because it's a song about longing for home. And in the song, and certainly correct me if I misinterpret anything, but the song seems to focus around this sailor who relays his day-to-day tasks that he taking from home, yet he often refers to thoughts of home and his loved ones, and that's what keeps him going.
I love that interpretation. That's
okay.
Fantastic.
All
that's
right.
Great.
Well, yeah. Well, tell us about The Call.
I wrote this song for my grandfather's funeral.
Oh, okay.
He was 104 years old when he died.
And, oh my.
So I think your interpretation is right on. You know, it's not necessarily the angle I was coming from knowingly, but just hearing what it means to you makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather was born in Rhode Island. He was in the Navy in his younger years for a little bit, and spent most of his life in Rhode Island. The song is an ode to him, and I really couldn't believe what just the longevity and not just longevity. I mean, he was in good health up until the
Mm-hmm.
day that he died.
Mm-hmm.
He lived alone.
Mm-hmm.
He was really admirable in so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the song came from.
Okay.
I wrote it for him. Just the week after he died, my dad called and asked if I would sing at the funeral. And so this was what I came up with. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a beautiful song as a tribute to your
Thank
grandfather.
You.
Knowing that, I can go and listen to it maybe with a little bit different set of ears. Because, you know, I mean, that's one of the things that songs about sailors and the sea are, I mean, there's nothing new about that. We've got lots and lots of sea chanties and all kinds of odes and things. I live right now, you know, pretty close to, you know, Lake Superior. So, I mean, the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, I mean, you know, we really embrace that particular Gordon Lightfoot song, since it occurred for real right up here on the Great Lakes.
Right.
But, you know, but the idea that, that, you know, someone who is a sailor, they're gone away from a long, long time from home. And I just love the idea that it is those thoughts of home and loved ones that seem to renew our spirit and keep us going and getting through those day-to-day tasks. We could probably apply that to almost anything, even though we're not gone for weeks or months at a time, even a stretch of 8 or 9 hours in a normal workday. And, you know, and you think about, I was interviewing a singer last week, maybe the week before, and I said, no, it was last week, singer-songwriter up in Canada. And I asked him, I said, what's your main motivation for writing? He says, I'm always thinking about my wife and kids and how I've got to keep going to support them. Now, because I could, then I said, well, I think that's an excellent motivation. So let me reword that. Then I asked him what his inspiration was for his songs. Mm-hmm. His motivation for songs, of course, was to find a way to keep going, make a living and so on. But I thought that was very interesting. The title cut for the album, Gently As I Go, is another leaving home behind kind of song. But this one came across to me as one leaving because of the end of a relationship.
That's right.
Is that, yeah. Oh, I'm on spot again.
Huh? You're on. Yeah.
Wow, I tell you, I should go buy a lottery ticket. But talk about Gently As I Go, please.
Sure. Yeah. I was touring with another singer-songwriter, and the two of us had this great relationship where we kept each other company and kept each other motivated on the road. And we did that on and off for a couple of years. And it was, it's interesting to hear you say leaving home, because when you're traveling with somebody and there is no other home, that person becomes your home. And when it ends, it does feel like leaving home. And so writing that song was a way to very much cathartically get out what was so upsetting in that moment in those days after that relationship ended. And I loved the advice that my sister gave me when I called her upset about how things had happened. And she said, you know, just when you leave, be sure to close the door gently. That's where the title came from.
Wow. That, you know, when you leave, be sure to close the door gently. That's a great piece of advice. Because we all have situations like that. Been thinking about that a lot the last couple of weeks, about the university where I taught full time. And one of my colleagues passed away a week ago Sunday. And
sorry.
Well, you know, and it's just one of the realities of, and so what that led me was to think about a lot of the people that I had known and worked with. And I started realizing how much what I missed from my work at the university was the people I worked with, my faculty colleagues, my colleagues from other institutions across the state that I worked with and so on. And I think that when you leave, close the door gently. That's really a great piece of advice, because I've known some people who left angrily, and that's not a good way to go, because you're not remembered well and you don't remember them well.
Right.
But I love that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, then I've got to go to the song, Do You Love Me? Mm-hmm. And Do You Love Me? I loved, because it seemed to me to be touched with just a bit of sarcastic humor. And if there's anything I like, is sarcasm.
Yeah.
Because the lyric is asking, with all that I do for you, do you love me? You know, how high do I have to stack it? You know,
sure.
I mean, and the things that you list, you know, I mean, the way you list, I thought that, to me, that's what tickled my innards, was all the little tasks and flossing my teeth and all that, you know, included. And I thought, this is basically a little bit of humor. Would you tell us more about this song? Share with us.
I mean, it's to me, it's as close to a children's song as I've ever gotten to writing.
Okay.
I think it could double almost as a children's book. But yeah, I wrote it in that part of a relationship when you're not totally sure where you sit with the other person, and so a little bit poking fun at my own feelings in that moment, just really laying it on thick in that bluegrassy style. I was on a retreat, actually a writer's residency, an artist residency, and had the opportunity to just sit and write for a few weeks, and a couple of songs came out during that time, and that was one of them.
Well, I'm only chuckling because it reminded me of me, because there's times when my wife will get a little bit upset with me about one thing or another, and then I start going, but I took out the trash, I walked the dog, I put the dishes away. I mean, what more can I do, you know? That's why your song resonated with me, and I thought, yeah, this is fun and just a bit sarcastic.
Well, good. You can learn it and sing it to her.
You know, I think I just might good. Do that. I'll get my ukulele out and learn. How many chords does it have?
Not many. I think it's like three.
Yep. Oh, good, because that's about all I can do on a ukulele is three chords. All right. Well, that's super. How about? Are there any other songs you'd like to talk about or highlight for my listeners?
I think you did a great job. I mean, how many are on the album? 10?
Well, let's see. You know, I wish I could remember, but I don't.
It's my album. You think I'd remember?
I'm pretty sure
it's somewhere around there.
You know, I think that sometimes we don't, and there's because we have so many other things to think about. So I'm going to Spotify and I'm looking, and there are 11 songs.
11 songs. Hey, nice.
Yes.
Bonus track. I think I've been surprised at how many people have been listening to Don't Wait. Spotify is fun for that reason, because, you know, I had great support on this album and sent out a bunch of physical CDs to people. So in that way, you don't really know what is landing, because there's no way to track that digitally. But with these streaming services, there is a way to track things digitally. And so it gives you more of a sense of which songs are resonating. And to me, it was nice to know that Don't Wait resonated as much as it did.
Well, from what I'm seeing on my Spotify page, yeah, resonating like six times more than any of your other songs, over 6,718 plays. And so, yes, that seems to be like your numero uno with listeners.
Yeah.
So
that song really came. Are you familiar with The Artist's Way?
Ray?
The Artist's Way. It's a Julia Cameron book.
No, I'm not.
Oh,
the
Julia
Artist's Way.
Yes, it's
looking it up right now.
It's a 12-week program.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it's from the 90s, but now that I've said that, I don't know exactly. Might be from the 80s. Anyhow, it's a 12-week program, and it's meant for artists of any kind. But I was flipping through the pages, looking for some inspiration and motivation, and just felt like the message that she had was really resonating for me in that moment. And that's where the song Don't Wait came from. Just a few lines of her motivational writing.
So is she one of those? I'm not familiar with the book, but I did look it up and found an article about it, and I'll learn more about it when we get through, because it sounds interesting. But Don't Wait, is that part of the idea of, hey, don't wait around for it to be
inspiration
perfect
to strike? Exactly. Yeah, right. There's just go ahead and write, and whatever comes out is not worth judging necessarily, just accepting and moving on.
Mm-hmm. You know, I still remember one of my committee members on my dissertation committee, when I was talking to her about troubles that I was having getting through, you know, writing part of it. And she just said to me, she said, Craig, part of your problem is you want it to be perfect when it hits the page. Just write, and then you can fix it later. And man, when I started doing that, I thought that was great. And, you know, it's like when I, in the latter few years of my full-time teaching career, I used to teach a class called Creative Thinking and Problem Solving. And I relied a lot on a book by the head of the design school at Stanford University. And I can't remember her name, and I don't see the book up here on my shelf. But anyway, she used to talk about at Stanford in the D school that they have, you know, two mantras, if you will. One is fail and fail big, because you learn from your failures. And number two is we build the plane while we're flying it. Because if you wait around, it's not going to get done. And I loved another meme I saw on Facebook today that said, success is you standing on top of a pile of your failures. And I thought, you know, that's really, really a great way to think. Because, you know, you don't really fail unless you give up. You know, you learn, you know, you don't win or lose, you win and learn. And I think that that's really sounds, I'm going to have to read that book. That sounds fascinating. Do you think that Don't Wait is popular because of the particular message that it's conveying, or what would you attribute it to?
I do. Yeah. I think that everybody, needs a little help, a little push. Gosh, me most days, but, yeah, I think that's why I think the message is strong there.
All right. Yeah. Well, I think we need that. I think that's why we like songs with a message. You know, it's what motivates us or gets us thinking about things. Have you had much feedback? I'm even going to skip my questions about the cathartic aspect, since we've kind of already talked about that. Okay. Have you had much actual feedback from people about your songs giving aid or comfort to people?
I have. It's so nice to receive messages about just that. And another song that a lot of people have written to me about is The Year of the Wrecking Ball. And that one is came from the letting go of my childhood home and looking back on that experience. There's quite a few people that have talked about that same experience and felt like this song really spoke to that, their experience of that as well.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think that one of the things about human beings, I think we do share similar emotions and experiences. And sometimes it takes a good artist like yourself to organize kind of those feelings so that it speaks to us a way. It gives us a message, gives us an opportunity to pause and comfort. I think words can be comforting. And I think that giving aid to others or making them feel better through music is a really great mission in life. That's wonderful. Well, let's kind of go back to your origin for a moment. Who or what turned the light on for you? First of all, what turned you on to music? What motivated you to play guitar, sing, and write songs?
I started playing the piano when I was really young, and I just loved listening to records in my living room and trying to play along with them. George Winston record, which actually is on the record player right now.
Is it his winter album?
It is. Yeah.
I loved George Winston's winter album. Yes. Of course, it's very appropriate for this time of year. Okay.
I know. Yeah. So just my parents' record collection is really what got me going. Some of my favorite records were the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds.
Oh, yeah.
Just their harmonies and, oh, my goodness, what a fantastic album. And the Beatles, the Magical Mystery Tour was another favorite. Just listening to these on repeat, and from a very young age. And then I don't think I played the guitar. I didn't start playing the guitar until I was in middle school, so around 12. And in fact, that was when we got our first computer. So it coincided where I could go onto the internet and find tabs and print out tabs so that I could figure out how to play these songs. First song that I learned how to play was Uncle John's Band. My brother was a Grateful Dead fan, and therefore I was a Grateful Dead fan. And they're great songs to learn, beginner guitar for sure. So yeah, and then the Indigo Girls were a big influence for me. Tom Petty, Paul Simon, these songwriters, and listened to a lot of Elton John and Billy Joel when I was in high school. And then older artists like Billie Holiday and Louis Armstrong were really influential as well. Yeah, I loved singing along to Frank Sinatra.
Well, it sounds like a lot of different influences, but I'm right there with you. One of my favorite recordings is Frank Sinatra Live at the Sands from about 1964 with the Count Basie Band. That's a great, and I always loved listening to groups with vocal harmonies like the Beach Boys. And I also loved like Crosby, Stills and Nash, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. Again, something about vocal harmonies and you know, singing that way, I always enjoyed. And so, yeah, right there with you on a number of things. Although that was never part of my parents' record collection. If I had ended up singing what was in my parents' record collection, it would have been Broadway musicals.
Well, that's actually one that I didn't mention, but in the rotation, very much so, was Godspell. When I was very young, even before I could speak in full sentences, I would tug at my mom's sleeve and say, "Pree, Pree," and that meant I wanted to hear Godspell because the first line of that whole musical
Prepare
is
"Prepare ye the way of the Lord." Yes,
got it. Yeah, yeah.
And that's a great. I love that musical. I saw it.
That
once.
Is fun. It is fun.
I saw Godspell at Ford's Theater in Washington D.C. in about 1978, I think it was, when I happened to be there in high school, and I've always loved Godspell. And but most of the musicals that I grew up listening to were like South Pacific and Flower Drum Song, the one that turned me on to being a musician and a band director was The Music Man. I'm still a little bit of Harold Hill, and I tell people in my band, I said, you know, you have to be careful. I'm going to con you to be into band, you know, join band. And I even have that as part of my signature on my email, is that famous quote by Harold Hill at the end of the show where he tells Winthrop, "Kid, I always believe there's a band somewhere."
Aww.
You know, so those are the things. But interesting that you know, your background with the rock and pop groups from the 60s and the 70s, and then also, you know, coming back with Billie Holiday and Louis Armstrong. And of course, Louis Armstrong, and I'm going to get on my professorial pedestal for a moment, but Louis Armstrong, without him, even Tony Bennett said this once, if you're not singing music with Louis Armstrong's phrasing, you're not truly singing American music. You know, that's how much he admired Louis Armstrong. But that's great. So you started playing guitar, you started learning songs. When did you start writing songs?
Not until later, 23, I think, 22.
Okay, so like after college.
After, it was a full year after I graduated from college. Felt like I had some things I wanted to say.
And then you, and then did you have any kind of formal training? I mean, when I say formal training, I don't mean like necessarily a class, but I mean about how to sit down and coordinate words and chords and create a melody and that sort of thing.
No, I was really just going off of what I'd been listening to my whole life, and and went from there. So yeah, I wrote songs for years and recorded songs for years, and just I think the more that I did it, the better they got, and maybe a little bit less wordy, and it took a while, and it's still taking time, and you know, I'll keep doing it. Hopefully I'll keep getting better.
Well, is songwriting for you something that pretty much comes together pretty quickly? In other words, does your muse just spew and it all comes out? Or are you someone that it really takes some crafting and some work to crank out a song?
I'd say both. So I just finished a commission. I was asked to write a song for a wedding anniversary. And so in that case, that took some crafting and quite a bit of work. And then there's the times when I'm feeling like I need to express myself, and all of a sudden 40 minutes later, I've got a song, you know. So there's the both ends of the spectrum are experiences that are possible.
Do you find that you are a daily writer? And I don't necessarily mean writing words and music, but at least journaling, or maybe you get an idea of a snippet and then you write it down or record it. Or do you do that pretty much on a daily basis?
I will tell you something that I'm not proud of. I was like that until I got a smartphone. And that was the end of my everyday journaling. I was a very dedicated journaler for years. And I got my first smartphone in 2015. And that was when I stopped writing every single day about my day. And it's something that in The Artist's Way, which I've mentioned, Julia Cameron's book, she part of her program is something called the morning pages. And so you write just when you wake up first thing before you get out of bed or get your coffee or whatever, you just write for 3 pages, and that's how you start your day. And I'll do that I'll get into some motivated rhythm where I'll get into that. But otherwise, no, it's not as steady a practice as I wish it were.
Well, you can always get back on the horse again sometime.
Every day is an opportunity.
That's right. You know, here's an interesting thing you need to think about. Today, you are the oldest you have ever been in your life. And you are the youngest you will ever be. And so it's fresh start time, see?
Absolutely.
Yeah, there you go. Well, then what typically, when you talk about when these inspirations hit, what type of inspirations are they? Are they usually negative emotions or positive emotions, or can they be either or both?
Could be either, yeah. It could be could be both wrapped into one, right?
Sure.
There's a really yucky feeling that could then yield some aha moment where you're like, okay, well... and I think that's actually probably where the best songs come from, is recognizing those dark feelings and then having some sort of a lift from that.
Well, that's not unlike, the composer Franz Schubert, you know, who wrote over 600 German Lieder, and only lived to be 31 years old. Once said that my misery is what kind of contributes to my production or my creativity. But when you are inspired, what usually comes first? Is a lyric come first, or do you hear a melodic line and then think, oh, this lyric might be good? Or do you hear a rhythm or a set of chord changes? What typically comes first to you?
I don't think there's a typical. Maybe a feeling and then a lyric, and the lyric will be accompanied by some sort of a melody. And so, but I've experienced songwriting in all of those ways that you just described.
Okay.
And, there's no one way that I approach songwriting from, that has worked for me again and again. So it's a little bit magical in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you're not a machine.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's always going to be, you know, different ways to do that. You talked about various singers and songwriters that you listened to growing up that motivated you to get into playing and singing music. But were there any specific artists who you feel were models for your vocal style and quality?
Mm. I listened to 10,000 Maniacs.
Natalie Merchant.
Yep. And I love it when people tell me that they hear Natalie Merchant in my voice. I loved singing along to her when I was growing up. So I'd say that she's the first that comes to mind there. Mm-hmm. Sarah McLachlan was another early one. I don't think that I really have emulated her vocal style, but she was somebody I listened to when I was little. And I think the Indigo Girls, I used to cover their songs a lot. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All great artists. Yeah, mm-hmm. I've enjoyed all of them. Mm-hmm. Well, then when we talk about, let's talk about contemporary singer-songwriters. Are there any who you particularly admire and maybe perhaps emulate?
Mm. I really love Anais Mitchell. I think she's such an incredible songwriter. And so has such a unique and interesting style. And not somebody that I emulate, but my favorite artist these days is John Batiste. He's just brings me so much joy on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. So just love listening to him. Yeah, it's sort of interesting to be a songwriter in my particular genre, because I do write in sometimes uplifting, but often dark themes on dark themes, and mm-hmm. some sad songs come out, and that's not the music that I listen to when I, mm-hmm. when I listen to music. I like uplifting music and mm-hmm. pop and funk and jazz and mm-hmm. Classical. I was surprised when Spotify told me that my top artist was Bach. And I was confused about why that was or how that was, but they encouraged me to thank him, and I said, "Well, that's not very possible." but the second most played for me was John Batiste, so that's why I mentioned him. Yeah, I'm really and I just watched the documentary that he made, American Symphony, and it was so inspiring about him and his wife and his musical journey and her struggle with cancer.
Mm.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to check that out. I
think you'll enjoy it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that sounds great. Well, thinking back on your life in music, what have been some of your most memorable musical experiences?
Hmm. Anytime I get to play with other musicians, it's the best. So most recently I've been playing with a pianist named Ben Cosgrove. He's fantastic. If you're not familiar with his music, I'll encourage you to look him up as well. And he's just such a talented and sensitive accompanist. So playing with him is a real joy. There's he plays piano and he also plays accordion. And at one of my most recent album release shows, I looked over and noticed that he was playing both at the same time. Mm-hmm. that was fun. And then I've got some other guys up here that I've been playing with who I'm really enjoying. I think because I traveled for so many years and traveled alone for many of those years, playing alone, it's just really joyful for me to collaborate with other musicians. And that did happen touring on the road. I had a lot of magical opportunities just for one-offs, you know, playing, being accompanied by musicians in the location where I was for a show here and there. That was always a joy.
Well, I could agree with you more. I think that, you know, when you get up on stage, it's the most fun you're going to have that night, and collaborating with others and, you know, people that speak the language of music and have a similar feeling about music that you do. That's always a pleasant experience. One of the things I'm always curious about, and again, this is part of your creative process. When you recorded your album, did any of the songs turn out differently after you went in the studio than you had conceived them going in? And if so, which ones and how?
I try and have pretty loose ideas of what I want when I go into the studio. That said, I'm also opinionated, and when something isn't working, no, no, that's not what I had in mind. But but I really enjoyed working with Alec on this project, because he does have some for me out of the box ideas, and some just things like different types of percussion that I just wouldn't have thought of. So something as simple as the claps on Don't Wait, and having them come in at the very, you know, at the end of the song, things like that, just little surprises that were fun in production stages. But nothing that was wildly different than what I had imagined. I really, because I've spent so long playing these songs, performing them, my hope and they stand alone, you know, so voice and guitar, or even in the case of Morning Mantra, just voice, they shouldn't need too much production. And so the production is just sort of like, you know, a feathered hat on top.
So it was mostly just, you know, little additions, some sprinkles on the frosting, so to speak. All right. That's good. Well, you know, I've talked to a number of singer-songwriters, and some, you know, like you, they go in with a very open mind and not a whole lot gets changed. And I've had some that have told me that they went in and somebody said, you know, the bridge really works better as the A section, and the A section works better as a bridge. In other words, totally, you know, turn things around or change some things, that sort of thing. So I guess, you know, it's always variable, but I'm always intrigued by, I mean, having experienced it myself, you know, the kind of creative work that can go on in the studio. And also, of course, with all of the technology that we have available to us, how much the engineer can alter sounds or make things, you know, enhance things. It's always a lot of fun. Well, kind of getting back to the basics, are you currently writing any new songs?
I am. And as I tell you about the last project, it makes me think those songs were pretty cooked when I got into the studio, you know, and this next batch is less cooked, I would say, you know, they're because of the past few years and how I really slowed down in my touring and performing. As things shut down and then slowly, very slowly, have opened back up, you know, I haven't been playing these newer songs as much. And so when I do go into the studio, if a song were to take a different shape, these would be more malleable, I think. So that'll be an interesting experiment when that happens.
You know, that's interesting. If you go in kind of with just a bare bones framework, and then get the production team or the other musicians saying, okay, how can we work to make this even better? I have a good friend of mine who's a studio musician in Los Angeles, and he tells me, he says that he always figures that his one number one job is that whoever he's called to go play behind on a recording session, his number one job is to make that artist sound better than they think they can sound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, what instrument does your friend play?
He's a baritone. Well, he's a saxophonist. His primary instrument is baritone sax, but he's, you know, he's played a lot of sessions at Capitol Records and in LA as well as other studios. He was a guest on my show. Well, it's probably been over 2 years ago now. He talked about that experience, and he told me some of his experiences of working, doing studio work and kind of the ups and downs and the ins and outs of trying to make a headliner star happy and in the way that they play things and do things, and maybe not so much always the star, but the conductor or the producer, whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely a job. Well, now that Gently As I Go is out, and it's been out now, let's see, September, October, November, December, almost 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
Are you planning your next album? And if so, what can you tell us about it?
Well, nothing's recorded yet. I do. I have, say, 9 or 10 songs.
Okay.
So probably writing a couple more. I did speak with Alec about going back to New York to record some songs. It'll be a while. You know, I take my time, but it won't take 5 years. I can tell you that.
Okay.
these last few years,
sure.
I felt just stretched out as
well. Ever. COVID really put a bump in the road, that's for sure, for a lot of us in a lot of ways.
Certainly turned our world upside down. So
yeah.
When I feel that I've played this one out to my heart's content, I will release some new music.
Okay. That sounds good. Have you considered releasing just singles, or are you going to hold out and just wait and do a whole album?
I have considered that.
Okay.
I think that it'll depend on how they sound to me and what I think is a good way to present them and share them with folks.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Caroline, would you please tell us about any live shows that you have coming up or any of the venues where you might typically appear?
Sure. So I'm going to be in Portsmouth, New Hampshire at the Music Hall Lounge on February 8th. That's a show that's coming up. I guess if this is airing in late January, that's a good couple weeks after that. And I will be going to Germany and Switzerland in March and April to perform there. I haven't been over in either of those countries to perform since 2019. I used to go twice a year over to Europe and play all over the place, but it's been a while and I'm really looking forward to getting back there. So a few of my supporters have gotten me to come back and I'm really excited. And then there will be, I know that there are other shows booked. I haven't put them on my website yet, but shows will be announced shortly.
Okay.
Within the next few weeks. So by the time this airs, they will be on my website.
Well, that's awesome. And just so you know, and just to remind my listeners, I do provide in my show notes a link to your website and your Facebook page. And links to anything that you might have on YouTube and all that, so my listeners can investigate you further and keep up with you as you go along. And that sounds like you're going to be keeping pretty busy then, going to Europe and performing in the Northeast and so on. And that's wonderful.
The other thing that I'd like to mention is that I have been leading, well, it's not a performance necessarily, but I do perform a couple of times over there. I'm taking a small group to Scotland in July, and so we've got space for a few more travelers to join that trip. It's something that I did for the first time last spring, and I'll go this July. It's a 10-day trip, and we have a group of 10 to 12 travelers, and we see Edinburgh and the Highlands. And I had never been before last year, and it's absolutely incredible. And I'm so excited to go back, and just gathering anybody who's interested to come with me.
Wow. Well, it sounds like you have not lost your wanderlust. You know, getting up and taking trips abroad and touring and whatnot. That's wonderful. Well, you know, Caroline, I try to be very thorough in my questioning and cover everything I can about an artist, but I know I'm not perfect. And so the last question I have to ask you, is there anything else that you would like to add or tell my audience that I have not asked you about?
I don't think so. Well, you know, I will say that as much wanderlust as I do have, I have landed in a pretty cool spot. I live right near Acadia National Park in Maine. Mm-hmm. And I would just encourage everybody who's listening to come on up here and check it out, and maybe even be a little bit more adventurous and check it out not in peak season, because peak season is a little bit crazy and beautiful, but it's really beautiful all times of year. So I guess that's all I'll say about that.
Yeah. Well, it must be a wonderful place. About a year ago, I interviewed a jazz saxophonist. His entire album has tunes that were inspired by what he saw at that park, Acadia National Park. So yeah, it must be beautiful there.
It is.
Yeah. Well, that sounds great. I have never been to Maine, so I need to find a good reason to come on up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wonderful. Well, that's just super. Well, Caroline, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. And
You're
I want to
welcome.
Wish
thank
you,
you.
I want to wish you all the best with what I'm sure is going to be a continued successful musical future.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, Craig. Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. My discovery composer of the week is Heinrich Ignaz Franz von Bieber. Baptized in 1644, he died in Salzburg in 1704. He was the outstanding violin virtuoso of the 17th century and a first-rate composer. He wrote instrumental or vocal, sacred or secular music with equal ease. His fame rests mainly upon his violin sonatas, especially those which require scordatura, but his polychoral church music has also attracted interest and admiration. Bieber may have had some music lessons, perhaps by the organist Wieglin Neufel in his birthplace, which was the property of Count Maximilian Liechtenstein-Castelcorno. He may have studied at a Jesuit gymnasium in Bohemia, and in the early 1660s, he was already on friendly terms with Pavel Wyszynowski, who was then studying with the Jesuits in Trapau. Before 1668, Bieber was a musician in the service of Prince Johann Seyfried Eggenberg in Graz. In 1668, he became a valet de chambre and musician to the Bishop of Olmütz, Karl Liechtenstein Castelcorno in Krommerich. Bieber was popular among the courtiers at Krommerich and was highly valued as a violin virtuoso. In the late summer 1670, the bishop sent Bieber to the violin maker Jakob Steiner in Absen to negotiate the purchase of new instruments for his ensemble. Instead of just visiting the violin maker, however, Bieber entered the service of the Archbishop of Salzburg, Maximilian Gandolf von Kunenburg. Bieber's career flourished in Salzburg. At the end of 1670, he had been classed among the valets de chambre, porters, and stokers of fires at court, with a relatively small monthly salary of about 10 florins. But the archbishop appreciated music for string instruments, and Bieber rose rapidly in the social scale. In the years 1676 to 1684, he dedicated 4 printed collections of instrumental music to the archbishop. On May 30, 1672, in Hellbrunn, he married Maria Weiss. In 1677, Bieber performed several of his sonatas in Luxembourg before Emperor Leopold I, who gave him a gold chain. And early in 1679, he was appointed deputy Kapellmeister. When he performed before the emperor for the second time in 1681, he petitioned him for promotion to the ranks of nobility. Bieber distinguished himself as a composer on the occasion of the Jubilee celebrations of 1682, and in 1684 was appointed Kapellmeister and Dean of the Choir School. After a second application to Emperor Leopold in 1690, he was raised to the noble rank of knight, with the title of Bieber von Biebern. Subsequently, the new archbishop, Johann Ernst, Count Thun, appointed him Lord High Steward, a title that marked the culmination of the composer's social career. In 1690, his salary had risen to 60 gulden a month, with free board and lodging, including such items as wine, bread, and firewood. Bieber had some 75 to 80 excellent singers and instrumentalists at his disposal in the 1690s. One might think that the most highly honored violin virtuoso of his time would have made some professional tours. Curiously, there is almost no information on the subject. He was well known in the emperor's dominions and in France and Italy for his music rather than for concert appearances. There is evidence that he was well known in Munich since he was decorated at the Bavarian court on 2 occasions. In his later years, Bieber seems to have devoted himself to the composition of sacred music, operas, and school dramas. Of the dramatic works, only one opera is extant. Only the librettos of the others remain. He wrote his last school drama in 1698 and his last opera in 1699. The All Music Guide lists over 80 recordings of Bieber's chamber music, 30 recordings of his choral music, 1 recording of his opera, Arminio, 17 recordings of his orchestral works, and 4 recordings of his music for solo voice. In my show notes is a link to a YouTube video performance of Bieber's cello battle, Die Schlacht, from La Battaglia, performed by The Voices of Music. Well, that puts a wrap on episode number 173. My show notes, along with links to artist websites, recording label websites, YouTube videos of artist performances, are all posted on my Facebook page, The Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. Next week, I'll be interviewing Nashville-based singer-songwriter Charlotte Morris. Other upcoming interviews include Arizona-based singer-songwriter Annie Moskow, singer-songwriter Spencer LaJoy, and New York State-based husband-and-wife folk duo, The Kennedys. Nashville-based soulful Americana singer-songwriter Nina DeVitri, and New York City-based composer, drummer, and educator Jake Richter. So don't touch that dial and stay tuned. If you have questions, comments, or a suggestion of an artist, composer, or musical style for me to consider, you may email me at hurstc@uwm.edu. So until next time, this is Professor Craig W. Hurst and Carmel the Wonder Dog, signing off from the musical universe of Professor Hurst. Have a great day.